On the next census, the Trump administration wants to ask whether or not you're a citizen. That question hasn't been asked for decades, and critics argue it should not be asked now.
I think it's time to be worried. I think it's time to really be worried about putting an untested question on the census at this late date.
Coming up, the census and the controversy. Plus, the Brookfield Zoo is making some changes.
People of all walks of life are able to come and experience the zoo whenever that they want to.
We'll find out how Brookfield is trying to become a more welcoming place for people with disabilities. And were you a Toys R Us kid?
I don't want to grow up. I'm a Toys R Us kid.
Now that the toy retailer is closing its doors, will you miss it? Or are you more of an online shopper now? Join us for our conversation by calling 1-800-222-9455. And stay tuned for the 21st after the news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nova Safo in for Nyla Boodoo. The Trump administration is facing major backlash over a plan to add a citizenship question to the U.S. Census. Illinois Attorney General Lisa Madigan has joined a coalition of 19 attorneys general and the state of Colorado in suing the Trump administration to scuttle that plan. The concern is that asking about citizenship status could depress immigrant participation in the once-a-decade count of the U.S. population, and that could have wide-reaching repercussions. John Thompson, who was in charge of the U.S. Census Bureau until last year, is also concerned about the citizenship question. He spoke with me by phone yesterday.
My biggest concern is that that question has not been tested in a contemporary census environment on the census. I know that people say it's on the American Community Survey, but that is not, in my opinion, the same as being included on the decennial census. I know others have expressed concerns that there could be a lack of response in certain communities, that there could be an undercount. I don't know if that would be the case, but I certainly think there's a significant risk of that. And at this point, I just wouldn't put that on the census without understanding what the impact would be. It could be really bad.
If minorities are undercounted in the next census, what are the repercussions of that?
There's some really serious repercussions. So first off, you know, the census is used for apportioning to Congress and for drawing district, redistricting. And, you know, if there's not fair representation, then the apportionment and the redistricting isn't fair. Another use of the census is to allocate federal funds. There's over $600 billion a year in federal funds that are allocated on census results. And again, if there's a lack of representation in the census, then that carries over to the allocation of funds. And then there are a number of data collection activities that are used both in the federal sector and the private sector to produce a lot of important statistics, like the American Community Survey, the Current Population Survey, which produces unemployment statistics. And these data collection activities are made representative by controlling to the results of the decennial census. And so if there's a lack of representation in the census, then that lack of representation carries over to these data collection activities as well. And so, for example, businesses that use the American Community Survey to make decisions about where to put companies based on local characteristics, they wouldn't have the full fair representation of communities because of the lack of representation. And that lack of representation will be in the data for the next 10 years. So that's why it's a pretty serious problem.
The Justice Department says we need to have this question about citizenship to help fight voter fraud in future elections. What do you make of that argument?
Well, I'm not an expert on how to prevent voter fraud or to use it. All I do know is that it seems that the Department of Justice has been able to carry out their mission without having that question on the census, from going back as far as in the 1980 census, the 1990 census, the 2000 census, and the 2010 census. It was not on the basic census. It seems like we've been able to accomplish our mission of enforcing fair voting rights in this country.
I understand that the citizenship question is also not the only thing you're concerned about. There were some efforts to change racial and ethnic categories that would be used in the upcoming census. What was that change supposed to be, and is it now moot, or could it still happen?
That is a really good question. So the Census Bureau, working in conjunction with the Office of Management and Budget, started looking at how to better ask race and ethnicity in the 2010 census. And that was based on using a combined question that combined the Hispanic question and the race question into one question. They took the work that they did in 2010, and they did a very extensive test in 2015. They presented their research results very widely, and they made a recommendation that the optimum way to ask race and ethnicity was by using a combined question. The important thing there is that in order to use that combined question, the Office of Management and Budget would have to change their standards, which would allow a combined question. And so the Census Bureau didn't hear anything from the Office of Management and Budget. They didn't hear anything about the Interagency Working Group report. And so ultimately, they were forced to make a decision to use the old questionnaire format.
So the significance of this is that Latino population would be counted differently, and there would be a new checkbox for people with roots from the Middle East and North Africa. Is that right?
Yes, that's part of it. The two-question format that has worked, and it's served its purpose. This was an opportunity to do it a little better, and they could have done it better. It could have gotten a more accurate count of Hispanics and of other racial categories, and it could have afforded an opportunity to count the Middle East and North African population more accurately. But we've missed that opportunity.
And how concerned are you then, in aggregate, about how accurate our 2020 census will be? Is it time to be worried? Is it too soon to be worried?
I think it's time to be worried. I think it's time to really be worried about putting an untested question on the census at this late date in the decade without any testing and without the opportunity to test, I should also say. It's very, very risky.
John Thompson, former head of the U.S. Census from Washington. Thank you.
Sure, no problem.
And that was John Thompson speaking with me yesterday. Joining us now are Anita Banerjee. She's with the Democracy Initiative, which is helping plan for the 2020 census here in Illinois. Welcome, Anita.
Thank you. With the Democracy Initiative at Forefront.
At the Forefront, a nonprofit. And here with me in studio is Hannah Meisel, a reporter with the legal news and analysis service Law360. Welcome to you, Hannah.
Thanks for having me.
And let's begin with you, Hannah. What has Illinois Attorney General Lisa Madigan said about this citizenship question since she is participating in a multi-state lawsuit?
Well, in February, Lisa Madigan and a coalition of 18 other attorneys general, they sent a letter to the U.S. Department of Commerce, urging them to reject the request from the DOJ in December to include the citizenship question on the census. Since the actual language that's proposed hasn't been filed yet, apparently it will come out tomorrow, the lawsuit that she and other attorneys general will participate in, that has not been filed yet. But in a statement yesterday, the attorney general, she said, the census is a fundamental part of our democracy, and if there are any barriers to being counted, I will take legal action to protect immigrant communities in Illinois. Because there is a lot at stake, like we just heard from our last guest, there's a lot at stake if the Illinois population is miscounted or undercounted.
So this is this citizenship question is being driven by DOJ, Department of Justice, which is requesting this. Ostensibly, they say to help fight voter fraud in future elections. The Trump administration is in charge of the Department of Justice. It's in charge of the U.S. Census Bureau. Presumably, they have the right to make these kinds of decisions. Do the states have any legal standing to oppose something that the Trump administration has every right to do?
It's true. They do have the right because under, the very old articles, it's been with us since the beginning of our nation.
It's the executive branch.
Yes, the executive branch does have the right to propose these questions. However, there has been legal challenges in the past to census in 1980, 1990s, for the 2000 census in 2010. So, for example, in 2010, New York felt it was way undercounted. New York ended up losing 2 seats in Congress because of its purported undercountedness of especially non-citizen populations. And so they sued, saying that it was just a fundamentally unfair. And, earlier this week, right when the Commerce Department came out and said, yes, we will add the citizenship question to the census, California actually sued first, and presumably California will also be included in this other lawsuit. But California's lawsuit says, first of all, it's a violation of the Constitution's actual enumeration mandate, meaning, because Secretary Wilbur Ross, he said, we need this citizenship data and it's worth the risk to for undercountedness. But California's lawsuit says, no, that's a violation of the Constitution because we have this mandate to get an actual count of residents.
Every single person, right. Citizen or not citizen.
And there's their other part of the lawsuit. It's a little bit in the weeds. They say it's in a violation of the Administrative Procedure Act, which basically it says that it's the court's responsibility to step in when a federal agency is not following the Constitution.
Now, Anita, to you, what could result from the citizenship question? How would it be seen by communities here in Illinois, communities that you are now trying to work up an outreach plan for the 2020 census?
Sure. So an untested citizenship question in Illinois could have far-reaching implications. The first and foremost being that immigrant communities, whether they are citizens or not, may fear filling out the census form. And when you then have communities that are already weary of filling out the form, not wanting to fill out the form, that risks not having a fair and accurate count. And when you don't have a fair and accurate count, and you are relying on these federal dollars that are based off the census count that come into your state over the course of 10 years, understanding that Illinois, by and large, already has a perennial state budget issue, the implications of not having adequate federal dollars coming to the state and going to the designated regions of the state that people are relying on these resources for is a really big issue. But beyond that, not having a fair and accurate count really kind of strikes to our representation in Congress, right? And having had population loss, we're already at risk of losing 1 seat, but it could potentially be 2. And it looks like we're one of the few states, if not the only state, that could lose 2 seats in this particular 2020 cycle. And so those implications are far-reaching, right? And then what does that mean for redistricting? What does that mean for our electoral college and the votes that could come from that? Like, this could go far and wide. But first and foremost, the question will really be targeting immigrant communities. And what does that mean for Illinois when we are already struggling to make ends meet?
What are some specific neighborhoods and communities that you are concerned would be most affected?
I believe it would be the undercounted, the hard-to-count communities, what that means for low income, what that means for people of color, what it means for immigrant communities, what it means for single families, what that means for early childhood, children 0 to 5, what it means for central and southern Illinois, particularly downstate, and what this means for rural communities, right? Like, the census is going online for the first time in its history. So understanding that these rural communities don't necessarily have access to broadband, what does that do in terms of self-reporting? And what does that do for those large immigrant communities in these rural communities that don't have access?
Is it a question that can be ignored by folks and just they fill out the rest of the census? Or is the concern that even just seeing that question brings up fear and they just walk away? What's the worry?
I think it's the latter. I think seeing that question will, first and foremost, I think people of immigrant communities are already weary of it. And it is incumbent upon organizations like Forefront that is helping pull together a statewide advocacy coalition to provide accurate information for people to feel safe in reporting. But that said, if you put a question like that on there, people are going to be less inclined. And so we absolutely agree with John Thompson, Mr. Thompson, that there's a real risk here that we may not have a fair and accurate count.
How much money are we talking about in Illinois that is at stake here from the federal government coming here?
So looking at the numbers from the there's a really great study that that was pulled together by Andrew Reimer at George Washington University, and he was able to kind of show about how much money is that the census is able to then pull state to state. And so it looks like Illinois gets about $19.7 billion, so roughly $20 billion, annually in federal funds. And not that we would stand to lose all of that, but it would be a significant portion of that. And it would be really based on our count to determine what that amount would be.
And Hannah, just in the last 30 seconds, you've touched on this earlier, but what's the next step in all these legal challenges?
So the next step, as soon as the Commerce Department comes out with the actual language tomorrow, we predict that that these states will, file their lawsuit. And then, because it is on a timeline, because the census does need to be wrapped up and tested, it's possible that the courts will take it up as an expedited matter.
All right. Hannah Meisel of Law 360 and Anita Banerjee of the Democracy Initiative at Forefront, a nonprofit preparing to conduct outreach for the 2020 census in Illinois. Thank you both very much for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
All right. We'll
be
right back on the 21st. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nova Safo in for Nyla Boodoo. Toys R Us. It's one of those brands that evokes memories and emotions for certain generations of Americans, but maybe not recent generations. After all, the retailer has declared bankruptcy and plans to close all its stores. There are a number of questions resulting from this development. Is Toys R Us an anomaly? What do all those store closings mean for Illinois communities? And if not Toys R Us, where are parents buying toys for their children? The answers coming up right now. Joining us is Bob Carr, head of the Illinois Retail Merchants Association, Christopher Merritt, who researches rural affairs at Western Illinois University, and Mary Hansen, reporter with NPR Illinois in Springfield, who has done some reporting on Toys R Us store closures. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Mary, let's begin with you. How many stores are closing here in Illinois?
So there are 31 Toys R Us and Babies R Us stores that are set to close in Illinois, and most of them are concentrated up in the Chicago area, although there's kind of a couple dotted, across downstate all the way to Fairview Heights outside of St. Louis, but most in the Chicago area.
And then just kind of spread out along the rest of Illinois.
Yep. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Nope, go ahead.
I know you visited one of these stores in Springfield. So what was it like there?
So I went last week before the liquidation sales were beginning. So it was a little calmer, I think, than what some folks have seen at Toys R Us since that has started. But there weren't any signs up or anything yet announcing its closure. There were kind of a lot of some customers coming in with questions, understandably so. There was a woman who came in at the same time as me who was returning something that she had bought at Christmas. And when she went to return it, they gave her a gift card back because it had passed the 30 days to get cash return. And she was understanding, but obviously a little frustrated, saying this gift card's only good until until all these stores are closed. So they kind of said, well, you gotta use it quickly. So lots
What's
of
it
questions.
Like, but... a lot of us who grew up, such as myself, who grew up seeing the Toys R Us commercials, maybe going in there as a kid, is Toys R Us still the same? Is the giraffe still there? What's it like inside those stores? Is it still a happy place?
I mean, it seemed so at that moment, although you could tell the kind of workers, there's a little bit of anxiety there. But yeah, I think it's still toys. It's still kids running around. So
at various levels of control, self-control.
Yeah, exactly.
If we want our audience to chime in here, if you have stories, memories, thoughts and feelings about Toys R Us and its closures, let us know. Call in to our phone number. It's 1-800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. We do want you to chime in, and we can tell you that we've had a lot of people chime in on social media on our various accounts, and I'd like to just give you a little sampling here. Kim on Facebook told us, went in twice, came out with a headache both times, never went back. Mary, that doesn't sound too great for Toys R Us. Is that part of the problem?
I think, people's kind of expectations, as we'll hear later from other folks, are kind of changing about the shopping experience. And for some, the giant box store with the big, lights shining overhead and the kind of overwhelming number of choices is not the ideal situation to be shopping in anymore. So some of that seems to have changed.
Mm-hmm. Rob Carr, President and CEO of the Illinois Retail Merchants Association, to you now. Has Toys R Us done a good job keeping up with the times? Presumably the answer is no. Where did it go wrong here?
Well, I think a lot of the folks who paid particular attention to these sectors would argue, and I've read many who have argued, that they did not keep up with the times. They did not keep up with the changing demands of the consumer. As Mary touched on, they're wanting experiences. I had not thought of it this way until she just mentioned it, but decluttered experiences, is a good good way to put it. They also did not keep up with technology. That experience today includes appealing to them on a variety of not only just technological platforms, but ways of reaching them, communicating with them, and appealing with them. They need a seamless shopping experience, and by all accounts, Toys R Us did not keep up with that. And then third, I think just how they differentiated themselves. I think one of the problems facing retail in general, very generally, is that how many different places can you buy certain things? How many places can you buy a polo shirt or a pair of pants or in the case of Toys R Us, a game of Uno or a Chance or Sorry? There didn't seem to be an effort on their part to differentiate themselves and to tap in, I think, what should be a nostalgic experience. And there is this whole generation that I am one of them that came up with Toys R Us kind of being a real icon. You'd think, given where we're at in terms of having our own children, that would be central. And I think they just missed that opportunity.
Mary, they're not the only retailer, though, closing stores. We don't want to pick on Toys R Us too much. Is the fact that Toys R Us is closing these stores out in more rural communities, is it compounding a problem out there? What are you seeing?
Sure. So Toys R Us is joining kind of a long list of stores that have closed branches across the state. Just before this, we saw Sam's Club closing a few stores in Illinois, and Kmart, Carson's, the department store, Sears. So a lot of these kind of legacy or big box stores. And it seems that they're kind of, when a Toys R Us or a Kmart closes in the kind of Chicago area, as we're seeing, there's lots of other options around, but in some places, in more rural areas or even in some smaller cities like Springfield or Champaign, those stores close and then there's other limited options. So I think some of the, when they close in smaller cities, kind of folks feel it a little bit more than maybe up in Chicago or other areas.
And Christopher Merritt, you run the Illinois Institute for Rural Affairs, studying some of these issues at Western Illinois University. What do these store closings do for local economies in smaller towns? Is it recoverable? Is Toys R Us going to cause some significant harm?
Yeah, I think it's first of all, it is correct to note that small town America, I think, is being hurt most dramatically by these closures. I think that's the communities at the bottom end of the urban hierarchy that are being affected most. And, you know, so the question is, what do you do when you lose that many people? So, you know, nationally, Toys R Us, I guess it's 735 stores and 33,000 employees. Those sound like big numbers and at a national level. But when a store closes locally, I mean, those are families are going to be losing income, a shuttered store. You know, that means reduced sales taxes. That means reduced property taxes. And so there's kind of a negative ripple effect, right? People have less money. There's laid off employees have less money in their pockets to spend. And something that's also not really sort of thought about is that when a store closes, it can actually affect the real estate values even in surrounding neighborhoods. And so we sort of think of a store closing as a single, very isolated sort of empirical phenomenon, but it has this community-wide ripple effect. Zillow, for example, talks about a Starbucks effect, where they talked about that if you lived within a quarter mile of a Starbucks within the last 20 years, your home value increased something like 96% because a Starbucks was this experience, right, which was mentioned earlier, that buying things can be positive. Well, that effect can work in the reverse, right? So if a desirable retail center node, if you will, that has nice stores, it closes, then that your neighborhood is viewed as being less desirable. Your real estate values go down. So it can actually have this community-wide ripple effect.
And did Toys R Us stores have the same kind of anchor role as other major brand stores have had in other communities, where it can, if they close, it can affect small businesses that are kind of hoping for those same customers to also drop by their stores? Or is Toys R Us kind of more limited?
I mean, you know, like any of these big box retailers, they are clustered and there is an anchor effect. And so I think you're right to people depend on car traffic and foot traffic. So if you're a small retailer next to a Best Buy or to a Sam's Club or a Toys R Us, you're sort of hoping that impulse buying will occur and that somebody who's going in to buy a new Playmobil or a Lego toy at the Toys R Us may also purchase something at your store because you happen to be close by. With that store closing, you know, that means diminished foot and car traffic, fewer consumers coming by your place.
And we'd like to remind our listeners to join our conversation. We'd love to know how your shopping habits are changing or what they are now, especially with these big box retailers closing shop. Our number to call is 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-9455. We do have a comment from one caller who left a message on our voicemail line. We'd like to play that for you now.
We still love brick-and-mortar stores. And yes, we miss Toys R Us, but our children are grown, and so we don't need toys anymore. Thank you. Brick and mortar stores, that's all we use. There is nothing by mail. Bye-bye.
A lot of people still, you know, in this online age, are relying on brick and mortar stores, right? Rob Carr?
Brick and mortar has not lost its draw, contrary to some headlines that you occasionally see. I have argued and continue to argue, and I think it's increasingly showing up in statistics and other studies, that actually online and brick and mortar retail, if you put them on a circle continuum, are starting to come back towards the middle, if you will, or come back together, where remote sellers are opening their own brick and mortar or they're partnering with brick and mortar, and brick and mortar has pushed into the remote selling space. So you really, as I touched on earlier, you really have to, if you're going to be successful, I think you really have to be in all of those sales channels. I think there was an early kind of foot in the, you know, a firm stance by some brick and mortars that they didn't need to do it and they were just going to resist. And I think early on, remote sellers likewise did not see the need to get into brick and mortar, but I think they're all learning and it's all coming back around. But brick and mortar is still an important and vital role. It's still where over 90% of the sales take place, at least in the United States. While it seems that we all shop everywhere and shop remote sales is growing at double-digit rates, it's still 90% of those sales are in brick and mortar.
I'd like to read another Facebook comment, this coming from Rebecca. She writes, "We only purchased toys we couldn't find anywhere else." She's referring to Toys R Us. "Their prices were always higher. I purchase most things online now. It's quicker and usually less expensive than stores. Plus, they are delivered to your door." Ouch. Rob Carr, while the lines are starting to fade, it seems like the smart businesses have to figure out how to exist in both online and offline worlds, right?
They absolutely do, and that does affect prices, and that in turn affects margins. And I think that in turn, while it may not be the case at Toys R Us, it is certainly with other brick and mortar locations. The days when when businesses would essentially subsidize underperforming stores are over. If stores are not meeting their mark, we will see more and more of those stores closing.
And which stores or which companies in Illinois, sorry to interrupt you, we're starting to get low on time. Which stores in Illinois that exist here in Illinois do you think are doing a really good job of competing, growing, and meeting the needs of the modern consumer?
Sure. It's always subjective. So I'm going to start calling out names. I hesitate. I'll probably offend a member at some point here. But I think Best Buy has done well. I think Kohl's is doing some very interesting things in the market. I don't know if people have caught up, but they've opened an experiment with Aldi where they're reducing some of their footprint and going to open some Aldi stores within, within the Kohl's stores, as well as their partnership with Amazon drop-off boxes. 7-Eleven has done some of that. I know that's not typically what we think of as retail, but it's, I think it shows the cross-pollinization of the different channels of retail. Those are just a few examples of many who I think are doing some interesting things in the retail space.
Mary, there in Springfield with the closure of Toys R Us and Babies R Us, any evidence yet of how those the area will recover or what can possibly replace it?
There's not specifically for the Toys R Us, but there has been some kind of there's constant churn in retail. So there's a Kmart that closed here in Springfield a couple of years ago, and I think a Binny's came in and redid that storefront. There's another couple; they're kind of trying to refill that plaza. So there is some recovery or some opportunity to have that, but it's just kind of wait and see if there's something else that will pop up. There's also across the street from the Toys R Us an Office Max that just closed, but that storefront is still, or that building is still empty. So it's kind of a mixed bag.
And Chris Merritt, what is the likelihood of recovery in smaller rural communities? Is it a longer term recovery? Is there a recovery at all?
I think it's going to be a longer-term recovery, and we can look at it both negatively and positively, right? So short-term, big negatives, there's large buildings that are going to be empty for a long time, but I think smart communities will be thinking about, well, what's the opportunity going forward? How can we repurpose these buildings? And there are many examples out there now of small towns and even large cities, you know, repurposing their vacant Walmarts and vacant Office Max stores as libraries, an indoor go-kart race track. A lot of the empty Sears have been converted into, for example, fitness centers. And so and another sort of opportunity is the traditional downtown areas in many communities, which struggled for many decades as suburban sprawl, big box stores developed, and they were left behind. I think smart towns are going to be thinking about how can we revitalize our downtowns, small-scale businesses, in the light of these big box closures.
All right, we'll have to leave it at that. Rob Carr, head of the Illinois Retail Merchants Association, Mary Hansen, reporter with NPR Illinois, and Christopher Merritt of Western Illinois University. Thank you all for your time.
Thanks so much.
Thank you
so much. I'd like to leave you one last comment from Facebook. Where are parents going to take their kids now to see all those toys? There's nothing like seeing the sparkle in the eyes of children when they discover toys on the shelf. Last thoughts on Toys R Us. You're listening to The 21st.
Support for The 21st comes from the U of I Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering, presenting Saturday Engineering for Everyone at the ECE building on Wright Street. This Saturday at 10 a.m., Professor Naresh Shanbhag discusses how new research is moving AI out of the cloud. go.ece.illinois.edu/c.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nova Safo in for Nyla Boodoo. When you think fashion capitals, what comes to mind? Paris, Milan, maybe Tokyo? How about Rockford? Well, perhaps it should be our very own Rockford, Illinois that comes to mind, hometown to the new artistic director of the billion-dollar fashion empire, Louis Vuitton. His name? Virgil Abloh, a graduate, by the way, of the Illinois Institute of Technology. So how did Mr. Abloh reach the stratospheric heights of high fashion? Washington Post critic, fashion critic Robin Given has the answer, and she joins us now. Welcome to The 21st.
Hi, it's nice to be here.
Pleasure is ours. Now, I will admit I'm not a big follower of fashion. You'd know that if you saw what I'm wearing today. But Mr. Abloh's story caught our eye. And before we get to how he got here, how he got where he is, what does it mean to be the artistic director of Louis Vuitton exactly?
Well, just to clarify, he's artistic director of the menswear.
That's right, menswear.
Creative director is Nicolas Gasquier, and he's in charge of the women's and sort of the advertising and sort of all of the creative elements of Vuitton. But essentially, Virgil will be in charge of creating menswear for the brand. And, you know, menswear has lots of room to grow. It's a smaller part of the Vuitton brand, which is really driven by its accessories. But I think the fact that it is driven by accessories is probably one of the reasons why they were drawn to Virgil.
Well, what do you mean?
Well, you know, I don't think that anyone would argue that he has sort of reinvented menswear or created a particularly distinctive silhouette. But he is really well known for being able to kind of capture popular culture and cool and celebrity and just sort of the excitement that surrounds a brand and connecting it with other brands. You know, he's sort of known as for his collaborations with a lot of unlikely sources, from IKEA, the Swedish furniture company, to, you know, fragrance brands. So he really is an extraordinary marketer, and he really speaks the language, I think, of popular culture.
Hmm. Were you at all surprised that Louis Vuitton would give him such a top-level position in a major fashion house?
Well, I mean, it was something that had been buzzed about and rumored. But I think on the one hand, the surprise comes from the fact that he doesn't have a traditional fashion background. He didn't study fashion, and he didn't apprentice with other brands. But I would say that there wasn't as much surprise because, you know, the nature of fashion is really changing, and the kinds of customers that fashion brands are reaching out to is changing. You know, luxury brands are no longer defined by solely by, you know, couture dresses and custom suits and things like that.
Is the fashion world fairly diverse, or is he injecting a new diversity into that world? How would you characterize that?
Well, diversity is something that the industry in general is sort of grappling with a lot of energy, I would say, particularly now. And that sort of started on the runways. But I think now, you know, the industry is starting to consider the people behind the scenes. And certainly behind the scenes at this level, it is not particularly diverse. There's a black designer at the French brand Belmain, the creative director there. But really, Virgil is a rarity at that level to be, you know, fronting and directing an enormous aspect of a luxury brand.
Yeah, he's African-American and he's under 40. And his background is really unlike many, I think, in the fashion world. He's from here, from Illinois, from Rockford, as we mentioned. His education is not in fashion. He has a master's in architecture, a bachelor's in civil engineering. How did he end up in the fashion world?
Well, I mean, I think there is a little bit of a precedent for, you know, with his, in terms of his background. There are a lot of designers who actually did study architecture. And I think that the connection is that both of those, both architecture and fashion, really focus on matters of construction as well as aesthetics, and also are sort of practical arts, in that, you know, you have to be able to live and or work in a building. You have to be able to wear and move in the clothes. And a lot of significant fashion designers are products of the Midwest. So it's not that uncommon. But he really came to the attention of the industry through his work with Kanye West. He was creative director with Kanye West. He interned at Fendi. And, you know, and he launched his own brand, Off-White, in a way that was sort of, you know, very, I think, respectful, for lack of a better word, to the way that the industry worked. You know, he didn't sort of go in full of hubris and saying, I know how to do this better than everyone else. He went into it as someone who, you know, clearly loved fashion and wanted and looked to be welcomed into the industry.
And a lot of us associate Louis Vuitton brand with that recognizable LV that we see on purses and luggage. We associate the brand with wealth and luxury. Now, knowing Virgil's background, I understand, is in streetwear and menswear. Is there an expectation that he's going to be subversive in that fashion house?
Well, you know, that's a good question. And, you know, we will soon see. You know, he debuts his first collection in June in Paris. I wouldn't say, though, that what he has done before is necessarily subversive, but I will say that it's been very skilled at being able to take what is sort of the aspirational aspects of brands, sort of the luxury, the prestige, and kind of turn it on its ear and offer a collaboration, offer something in a surprising way.
Mm. And that's Virgil Abloh, our own Illinois' own, now in charge of Louis Vuitton's menswear collection. We'll have to see what he comes up with. Robin Given of The Washington Post, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
From fashion to the zoo, going to the Brookfield Zoo hits all of your senses. The sound of kids screaming, the, shall we say, unique smell of the primate house, or even the feel of those Dippin' Dots dripping down your arm. Imagine trying to navigate all of that when your child has sensory sensitivity. Now, the Brookfield Zoo is trying to help with that with a sensory-friendly room and an inclusion resource center. There are noise-canceling headphones, dimmable lights, so families can enjoy a moment of calm before heading back into the chaos. The sensory-friendly room is the latest step in the zoo's efforts to be more inclusive and accessible for anyone and everyone who wants to enjoy a little bit of nature. We're joined on the line now by Dave Becker, Senior Manager of Learning Experiences for the Chicago Zoological Society, which runs the Brookfield Zoo, as well as by Ann Richards. She is a child life specialist at Lurie Children's Hospital, and she's on the line from Chicago. Welcome to you both.
Hi.
Thank you, Nova.
All right. Before we get into what Brookfield is doing, I'd love to discuss this issue of children with sensory sensitivity. It's not something I was actually familiar with. Can you explain what that is?
Yes. All of us get sensory input through our brains.
And we all have different levels that we can deal with. Everyone has their own sensory diet, so to speak. So there may be sounds, feelings, reaction to light, and we're all different about that. And that's why we call it a sensory spectrum, because some of us are on the further ends of it, some more in the middle. So,
when children are getting overwhelmed by sensory input, what does that lead to for them?
We call it being dysregulated. So whereas you or I might be able to regulate if we went into a loud room or a well-lit room, our sensory diet allows us to regulate our bodies. With these children, they aren't able to do that. So usually you will see them become dysregulated, which can mean they can fall to the floor, they can cover their ears, they can cover their eyes. If they don't have language, they can't tell you, but you can look at their bodies and tell that they are uncomfortable and are not able to take in what's around them.
Dave, that's a heartbreaking description, because this is going to the zoo should be something enjoyable for children. So I understand you guys are trying to address this. What are you doing for these children?
Yes, thank you. Anne described that very well. And so there's a number of things that we're doing. One is having resources available. So in our Hamill Family Play Zoo area, which is really our child-friendly area of the zoo. You can imagine it if you haven't visited there before. It's much like visiting a children's museum in a zoo surrounded by a children's garden, but with live plants and live animals and many opportunities to interact with nature. So in that area, we've added an inclusion resource center, which is somewhat like a help desk, but very much focused on inclusion and accessibility. So there are things, as you mentioned in your intro, the noise-reducing headphones, visual schedules, which are a resource that helps a child or helps a family plan their day and plan what they're going to do next, and just helps with that regulation. Social stories, which are stories that can be read in advance or even during the time of, that's like gives a sense of, well, what are some of the things that you're going to experience? And so it provides with just some additional supports for planning and making sense of the experience. The other piece from a physical resource point that you mentioned, Nova, in your intro, is we added a sensory-friendly family room, which is a small, cozy room with a couch and a beanbag chair. It's a private room, so that when you enter the room and turn the latch, it indicates to people that it's occupied, so that people from outside of the room know that there's a family there and that it's occupied. And then the families that are in the room really have a choice about how the type of sensory input that they need at that moment, either by adjusting the lights, which can go from very bright to dark, not just by the adjustable lights, but the fact that we've got the heavy curtains. There's a bubble tube, which is has a calming effect for some children or some people on the autism spectrum, but that can be turned on and off. And then there's other resources that are available in the room. Some of the things, again, that we've mentioned, the weighted lap blankets that provide just that, sometimes that sense of having pressure can help have a calming effect. There's a variety of different kind of small toys and manipulatives that get referred to as fidgets. There are things that you can hold in your hands that have different
kind of sensory, almost if you imagine as many people in their office use a squeeze ball to help mm-hmm. with stress. It has that same kind of effect.
Yeah, and just just a few minutes we have left here. How important are these kinds of interventions to help children cope?
Oh, very important. They would be probably unable to go into a zoo environment, museum environment, in the traditional sense, because of the lighting and the noise. So this allows them to regulate and to be able to learn. And many of the things that were mentioned, typically developing children also like. Mm-hmm. So it sort of pairs kids up in this regard to learn about each other.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it at that. So much more we could say, but we're looking forward to see what else Brookfield Zoo comes up with. Dave Becker with the Chicago Zoological Society and Ann Richards with Lurie Children's Hospital. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. And that's all for today's show. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. I'm Nova Safo in for Naya Labudu. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.